Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us at The Constitution Matters. We the people, you're on 1180 WFYL, working for your liberty. Mike Levin's here along with Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, and Phil Duffy, teacher at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute on the Constitution, both gentlemen joining us on the day which many of you are observing our Independence Day. And if you have the day off from work, well, consider yourself blessed, because we're here working for your liberty. Gentlemen, wonderful to have you with us again for the program today.
Well, thank you,
good
Mike.
To be here.
It's great to be on the show again, and I want to point out one thing. As you alluded to, some of our normal listeners who would be listening to us on the radio going to work may be able to listen to us now at home in the comfort of the home and be able to call in with some questions. How about that?
Well, yeah, and that number is 610-539-TALK, which you could call with questions for Gary or Phil. They are the experts on the Constitution, and we'll dive right into it this morning. We are going to be reflecting on the latest Supreme Court decision. That's right. That is going to be the decision on homosexual marriage, and the case formally is Obergefell versus Hodges. But what we are going to be looking at first is actually quite a picture in light of Independence Day. A figure known as Caesar Rodney, which some may not know of, but who was the deciding factor in our independence. And Gary, in your essay, you draw quite a provocative picture of this man and the part he would come to play in our nation's independence.
Well, yes, indeed. And it's one of those stories that you never hear told in normal renditions of the Declaration of Independence. But it makes a very important point, and the reason I included it in the essay. Because we need more Caesar Rodneys, if you will, today, and we're going to need a lot of them if we're going to turn this country around. Basically, Caesar Rodney was appointed as a delegate, the third delegate, to the Delaware delegation at the Constitutional Convention, the Continental Congress is the term we're looking for, which was considering independence in July of 1776. Unfortunately, he was sick at bed with both skin cancer and asthma, and he could not attend. Well, on the 1st of July, the Congress turned around to their first attempt to vote on this resolution of Richard Henry Lee's that had been introduced nearly a month before on the 7th of June. And they took a test vote, if you will, as the Committee of the Whole on the 1st of July. And in that test vote, Delaware, with only their two of the three delegates in attendance, split their vote. One delegate was for the resolution, one was against it. And so Delaware's official vote as a delegation became a nullity, as they call it, a null vote, a non-vote, not quite the same as an abstention, because they did vote, but it turned out to be zero rather than one in favor or one against, in terms of the delegation itself. So there were other delegations that voted, of course, and the final vote was only nine colonies in favor of independence. That was certainly not the unanimous condition that those pushing for independence were hoping for. That was not the united front they wanted to provide to Great Britain. So if they had reformed themselves immediately there at the convention as the Congress itself, rather than the Committee of the Whole, and taken the binding vote that only the Congress could take, then they knew that that would be the result, 9-4, basically, or 9-3-1. And they didn't want to do that. So South Carolina asked for the binding vote to be postponed a day until the next day. And that would give, that certainly imply that South Carolina wanted to have a chance to reconsider their no vote and give other delegations a chance to reconsider as well before the binding vote is taken the next day. So the next day, then, just as they're reconvening, in walks Caesar Rodney, splattered with mud, still in his spurs, having ridden all night, got up from his sickbed at the news of what had happened there in Philadelphia, 80 miles away, that day. And so he had gotten up from his sick bed and ridden all night to be there the next day and cast his vote in favor of independence. And that turned the Delaware delegation from a nullity into a vote in favor, 2-1 within the delegation. And lo and behold, South Carolina had changed their vote from the previous day after further reflection. And Pennsylvania, which had voted no, was now able to record a yes vote because two of their delegates, Robert Morris and John Dickinson, were suddenly absent. Their two chairs were empty. They had seen the light as well, and even though they could not themselves vote for independence, they realized that a unanimous front had to be presented to Great Britain, so they stayed home, and that allowed the Pennsylvania delegation's vote to swing from no to yes, and that left only New York, which was still lacking instructions that allowed them to even record a vote one way or the other. So they could only abstain once again, but now it was 12-1, quite different than the 9-4 of the previous day. So 12-1 was close enough to unanimous, and they were able to say this resolution passes. Well, it would have passed even at 9-4, but now it was 12-1. It passed, and they could turn their attention to the draft of the declaration that John Adams' committee had presented them the previous Friday. And of course, we know then they came up with the Declaration of Independence, approved that reasoning or the wording of that on the 4th of July. And then on the 19th of July, New York's delegation received new instructions that allowed them to vote in favor, which they did. That then became the unanimous declaration of independence that we know today. So it's a very stirring story, but it looks, you have to look at the character of these men, and particularly Caesar Rodney. Are the Caesar Rodneys today? Where are the people who are willing to get up from their sick beds, theoretically, and do what it needs to be done to steer this country back on track? That's the question that I'm asking, and that's why I put that section in the essay.
The figure of Caesar Rodney is a very provocative one. You talk about how he came in with bandages on his cancerous cheek. I'm sure it was not a pretty sight to behold, but it was a sight that he came to grace that convention with, as he would provide a swing vote for the delegation of Delaware to provide that united front, which was so important in declaring independence against Britain. Now, Phil, what do you know about the figure of Caesar Rodney, and how can the figure of Caesar Rodney be an inspiration to us as Americans, just as the question that Gary posed. Where are the Caesar Rodneys, the ones who are willing to stand up even when their bodies may fail them and go against what their colleagues may even be in favor of?
I think this is an even broader question than the territorial limits of the United States. More recently, some of us have some remembrance of the Nazi era. And during that period, of course, we know that most people caved in and went along and allowed these hoodlums to run the country. And yet there was one individual called the Lion of Münster. He was the Archbishop of Münster, Archbishop von Galen, who stood up to Hitler in the pulpit and voiced the opinion that euthanasia was wrong, that it was being conducted by the Nazis, and his inspiration went on to be a part of the White Rose movement, which was a major defiance of Hitler and National Socialism. So, you know, the question is, where are these heroes? First of all, and Gary has done a marvelous job of this, I believe. First of all, we have to have people like Gary talking about these heroes. And then we have to take them into our culture. This has to be an important part of how we're brought up, how we teach the next generations. And, of course, we've talked, I think, for three sessions on the issue of education. We can't rely upon the public educational system to pass these kinds of stories on.
In the course of history, these figures have unfortunately have gone to the dark corners. They've been forgotten. They've gotten dusty, and as Americans, we need to find them again, dust them off, and get inspiration for our day. Many who would be discouraged at the current course of our country, and that, I would contend, would be the majority of the population. We cannot rely on the current institutions that we have to present these things to us accurately. We need to find, and there's an interesting scripture that comes to mind when I think about this, and it comes from Jeremiah. Look for the ancient path and walk in it. There you will find truth, and there you will find basically your pathway to liberty. And I think that the same principle applies today, where we look at the founders and we look at our history and some of these figures that have unfortunately fallen into obscurity, and we could see the heroes, people who stood up even when they were the only ones standing, but now we look at in the light of history and commend greatly, Gary.
And I'm glad Phil brought up the example of Nazism, because that brings to mind one more hero that I think we need to have in the forefront of our minds today, and that is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Not only was he a hero in the general sense, he was a pastor, a Lutheran pastor, who became a hero by speaking up against the Nazis and their programs. It cost him his life. He was executed by the Nazis just a few months before the war eventually ended. And he paid for the ultimate price, but he spoke up when others were silent. And there's a famous quotation attributed to him, which is that to not speak is to speak. And so to not say something about a wrong or an evil is in fact to endorse it. You can't just remain silent and say, well, I'm going to stay out of this fight. To not speak is, in fact, to speak. And so what we need today is we need people to be speaking about this, to be discussing it in their churches, discussing it with their pastors, and deciding how, as a people, they are going to respond to this. Otherwise, they are endorsing it, and as I point out in my essay, it is going to lead to even greater grotesqueness.
If you are not for me, then you are against me, of course, are the words of Jesus. Obergefell versus Hodges draws a line in the sand, a line that is going to become clearer and clearer as we progress into the implications of this decision. Do you not agree, gentlemen?
Oh, absolutely.
Most certainly. Go ahead.
Phil, I want to ask you, being a constitutional teacher, Obergefell versus Hodges, will dive into the actual constitutionality of the decision later in the program, but Obergefell versus Hodges, this decision, how do you think the implications will play out, and what opportunity will that give for Caesar Rodney's to rise in our culture? What may be the atmosphere?
Well, first, there are two paths that we can travel, and I suppose some variations in between. But the major paths are a continuation of the past, the drift towards this kind of secular society that where language is redefined according to the needs of the immediate perceptions of so-called thought leaders. And then there's the alternative, which is a recognition finally of the absurdity of this kind of thinking and a delving, if you will, for the underlying causes. You know, how is it that we allowed ourselves to get to this point from that remarkable moment in time when the Constitution of the United States was ratified in 1789?
Well, a life dictated by feelings is a life that is swayed as if by waves in the ocean. Gary, you allude to this in your essay. Now, is this merely what we're dealing with here? Feelings of a nation that sway back and forth, and that we may look at in 30, 40, 50 years, whatever the consequences of our decisions today may be, and anguish over?
Well, that's certainly what the majority opinion based its arguments upon, is that feelings are so important that we must protect them under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And so basically they said if it feels good, it must be right. And therefore, if it feels right for two people of the same sex to come together in an agreement to live together, then we must grant them, therefore, the title of marriage, even if marriage has traditionally not been extended to that kind of a pairing. Well, that's not constitutional law. That really isn't. And John Roberts and Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas point this out in their dissents. This decision was not based on constitutional law. It was based on feelings. It was based on social policy. As I point out in the essay, our five jurists took off their black robes and put on the pocket protectors and the clipboards of social scientists. They basically decided they were going to enact social policy through the veneer of law, and that's not what we hired them to do. That's not what they were appointed to do.
Gary, you mentioned Dietrich Bonhoeffer before, who is one of the most famous Christian theologians, and his works are held in very high regard because of his persecution and his outspokenness against the Nazis in Germany, and how he advocated for the gospel even when the times were getting dark, being a, quote, Caesar Rodney, if you will. For those who may be listening and have not heard that name before, to provide a little background, Phil, do you see a parallel, again, constitutional teachers, both of you are, but do you see a parallel, can we draw the same parallel with a Dietrich Bonhoeffer who stood up in Nazi Germany to constitutional examples like a Caesar Rodney?
The parallel is absolutely clear, no question about it. Both acted in very similar circumstances where they had to go against the crowd, if you will, and both sacrificed greatly, and that is absolutely what we need.
And the reason I ask that question, because Dietrich Bonhoeffer is a pastor, not a legislator, but then you have Caesar Rodney, who is a legislator, and conventional thought at least of what may be popular today, is to separate the secular and the religious. So I ask that question to say, is there a parallel? Because even though Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a pastor, and even though he advocated for Christianity, for the gospel in his time, is there still a direct correlation between what he was doing and what the Caesar Rodneys in our American history have done? And Gary, if you'd like to take that one, you can.
Well, yes, in previous discussions, previous essays on the founders' worldview, we've pointed out that today's Congress self-identifies 92% as Christian. So if we, in fact, have 92% Christians in our Congress, which is significantly more than the 74%, I believe, of the general public, then if that's true, and if they are Dietrich Bonhoeffers, if you will, then we ought to be able to see some legislation coming out that reflects Christian values. Unfortunately, we don't see that consistently enough, and therefore I think we have some of those 92% who are Christians in name only are not willing to let their religious tenets guide their legislative activity. Well, I don't think that's correct. I don't think that's a correct way to approach the legislative responsibilities.
Now, the conventional acronym for Republicans in name only is, of course, RINOs. Now, Christians in name only does not come off the tongue as easily as that, and quite frankly, I wouldn't know what would be the correct way to pronounce that. But it all begs the question of, where are today's Caesar Rodneys? Especially with that statistic, 92% of our congressional leaders declaring themselves as Christians, actually greater than the American population, which declares themselves as Christians. Phil, your thoughts on that?
It is. It's a remarkable detachment, no question about that. It seems to me that we're dealing with the issue of power. You know, who is our God? Is our God the God that of the Christian faith? Or is our God power? And I think what happens is that these Christians in name only, they bend the knee to power first.
And
right.
When that
power
happens, then they get, and I think you were just about to go with that with the phrase I was thinking, Gary.
Well, it's the power of money, first of all, and that was most fittingly revealed in these votes on the Trade Promotion Authority. Someone pointed out very eloquently how many votes were purchased, basically, by the corporate money that came flowing in to ensure that that passed. But that's just one example of how money and power, the power of money, has swayed our representatives in ways that sometimes have reflected votes opposite what they claim to be in terms of their religious persuasion.
Now, for those who would claim that Christianity has nothing to do with our country at all, I would say pay heed to those statistics, because historically, Christianity has been inextricably linked with our country. We're going to head to a break. We're at the halfway point of our program, and we're going to talk about the mechanics of the Obergefell Hodges decision, the recent Supreme Court decision on gay marriage, and talk about, was it even constitutional? We've already said that it's not, but why? We're going to dig into that. We're going to dig into the implications for the Christian community. You could call in at 610-539-TALK if you have a question for Gary or Phil, who both are experts in the Constitution and both teach on the Constitution. You're listening to 1180 WFYL, Working for Your Liberty. Mike Levin's here. We will return in just a moment. Again, that number, 610-539-TALK, 610-539-TALK. Happy observance of Independence Day. We will return momentarily.
Thank you. freedom shining right from Philly to the nations. 1180 shining forth, we are the Freedom Station, WFYN.
News Radio. I'm Chris Foster. No one's saying there are specific threats, but security in some cities has stepped up this 4th of July weekend. Fox's Doug Luzader in D.C.
The challenge with the 4th of July is that you have so many events going on from one end of the country to the other, from small towns to large cities. It becomes a real challenge for law enforcement and for U.S. intelligence agencies tracking this evolving terror threat that doesn't involve kind of that top-down hierarchy of Al-Qaeda, but rather a decentralized threat with ISIS trying to inspire lone wolf gunmen through the use of social media.
In Athens, Greece, rallies for and against spending cuts in exchange for more bailout money. There's a referendum on Sunday.
For the fifth day, people are still limited to only receiving 60 euros out of machines, and bank branches across the country remain closed.
Sky News correspondent Robert Nisbet in Athens. Fox News, we report. You decide.
Hey, Grandma, can you help me with my Common Core lesson on the Constitution? But the only part we're reading in eighth grade is the preamble and the First Amendment. I wonder when we'll get to study the rest of it. Didn't you say our founding fathers were wise patriots and wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights to protect our freedom? This Common Core book we're reading says our founding fathers were racist and they didn't think women or blacks should ever be allowed to vote. She says, we the people, didn't really mean you and me, but some rich white guys. That just makes me feel terrible about our country. We need to change things.
Oh, honey, that's not true at all. Our country is the greatest country the world has ever seen, and our founding fathers worked hard to be fair to everyone. I'm going to call our school board and our state board of education and ask why they allow Common Core and this book in your school.
Call your representatives now and ask them to stop Common Core and restore local control. Pennsylvanians Against Common Core brought you this message. Go to nopacommoncore.com or call 484-678-2236.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mention WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Across the fruited plain today, many are enjoying a wonderful day off from work in observance of Independence Day. And if you're listening this morning, thank you for joining us. We are here, still working for your liberty. Mike Levins, Gary Porter, and Phil Duffy, all joining you, and thank you for joining us. You could call in and let your voice be heard. Any questions you may have for Gary or Phil, that number is 610-539-TALK, 610-539-8255, and you are listening to We the People, The Constitution Matters, where we talk about the Constitution, how it matters for today, and how we could learn from our founders and the history that surrounds it. Now, what we will be digging into in this portion of the program is the latest decision by the Supreme Court on gay marriage, Obergefell versus Hodges. And there's a correlation that exists between another very famous Supreme Court decision, Roe versus Wade. Gary is going to paint a picture of that correlation for us. Go ahead.
Well, yes, Roe v. Wade, decided in 1973, of course,
struck down many state prohibitions or restrictions on abortion and made basically abortion freely available across the country up until a certain point in the pregnancy. And yet, let's look at what has become of that, quote, law of the land, if we will give that Roe v. Wade decision that distinction. Today, a pregnant woman cannot go into any obstetrician's office and demand that he perform an abortion because it is the law of the land, right? Well, so why is that? Why do we give doctors the right to not perform abortions under certain circumstances? We do that because there's a moral code to which we allow them to fall upon when performing an abortion would be against their morality or their religious feelings. So we don't demand that doctors perform abortions, and we accept that situation across the nation. So let's look at and compare that then to this marriage question. Why do we insist that Christian businessmen who have religious restrictions, or not restrictions, but religious feelings about whether a homosexual marriage should be supported or not, why do we insist that they bake their cakes and provide their flowers and do these sorts of things against their religious feelings? Why do not we grant them a religious exemption as we do in the abortion question? Well, I think it's a very fair question. I think we need to discuss this relationship as a nation. We have made the religious exemption in one case, in the Roe v. Wade case, and we seem ready to deny the religious exemption in this marriage question. I don't think that's consistent, and I think we need to reflect on that.
Phil, your thoughts?
Well, what I'd like to do here, if I can, Mike, is to get to the overall decision here and the logic of it, so we could put Gary's thoughts into perspective. And Gary passed the decision along to us and asked us to analyze it. And what I've done here is to look at it basically through the plaintiff's eyes, if you will, and also from a non-faith-based approach. And why do that? And the reason is I think you can come to the same conclusions from various perspectives. So apparently the opinion of the majority turns on this thought. The 14th Amendment requires the state to license a marriage between two people of the same sex and to recognize a marriage between two people of the same sex when their marriage was lawfully licensed and performed out of state. That's the basic logic, if you will. Now, even the Supreme Court recognized that this bald statement by itself would not fly. So the majority launched into a lengthy explanation of how it came to that conclusion. And in doing that, it was first necessary to acknowledge that historically marriage had been recognized as a union between two peoples of opposite sexes. Both the majority of the justices asserted in their judicial role, they had discovered a new truth, however. And the opinion continues, and they say the petitioners, far from seeking to devalue marriage, seek it for themselves because of their respect and need for its privileges and responsibilities. Well, first, what are its privileges? I mean, from a purely secular, if you will, or constitutional view here, it's not the privilege of claiming to be married. Free speech guarantees that. Okay, the same-sex couples can claim anything they wish, but others don't have to take the claims seriously. But I could have been convinced of their case, if you will, if they had identified preferential tax treatment for married couples. Okay, we have to acknowledge that. But the opinion did not mention that, which led me to suspect that they could have led, the majority could have been led into a greater thicket and didn't want to go down that road. By responsibilities, I assume they're talking about adoption of children. But now let's consider, you know, what all of this means. The reader of the opinion is then treated to a history lesson, and I think this is where it starts to break down, where their case breaks down. It's a history lesson on marriage with the following leading statement. the history of marriage is one of both continuity and change. Now, they identify a number of changes, and most people would recognize and acknowledge those. But they never explore the continuity part of this thing. It's like it just drops off the table. And if they did, they would have to come back to the fact that the continuity part is a man and a woman entering into this institution. So the majority opinion now really goes off the rails with the following statement. The fundamental liberties protected by the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause extend to certain personal choices central to individual dignity. Remember that, dignity and autonomy, okay, including intimate choices defining personal identity and beliefs. Since when? Let's examine that thought a little more closely.
And also you could look at why is dignity determined by a legal system?
Yes. Now, think of the implications, and I'm just about through with this thought. They're making the claim that the realm of law extends to feelings and not just antisocial actions. In other words, if my feelings are hurt, I ought to have recourse to the law. Now, think of the implications of that. First, it will be necessary to assemble judges and juries to take on the infinite number of cases arising from hurt feelings, but that's not going to be enough. We'll also need to constitute a feelings police force and a feelings prosecutor. And if all of that seems absurd, consider the powers of the worst tyrannies extend to punishing beliefs and feelings. You don't need law for that. So this is not due process of law in this decision. It ultimately becomes a disregard for the law.
And if we're based on feelings, we again, what determines dignity based in the law? And like you said, we have feeling police. Are we going to have feeling juries? Are we going to have a feeling system of justice, which would be no system of justice at all?
Absolutely.
Gary, elaborate for us. Are we misunderstanding something here?
We're not misunderstanding the majority opinion, that's for sure. Phil has captured it precisely. And the other aspect of it that I would mention was this reliance on individual autonomy. The quote is, the right to personal choice regarding marriage is inherent in the concept of individual autonomy. Well, what is individual autonomy? And we're now going to protect individual autonomy by the Constitution, apparently. And of course, if you are going to grant individual autonomy's protection by the Constitution, then where does that stop? That begs the question of this transgender question. Where does individual autonomy stop, and are we going to start now protecting, via the Constitution, your right to be anything you want to be according to your definition of individual autonomy? Well, as the dissidents rightly point out, this decision is going to open up a floodgate of litigation because of the precedents that they've used in their arguments. Or the arguments themselves that the majority has used, there is going to be all kinds of litigation based on this. It's going to be a flood, as I point out in my essay.
Well, and it's the elephant in the room. I remember in college taking a psychology course, and of course the psychological manual for diagnostical psychological diagnostical statistical manual. I don't know if that's the exact verbiage, because it's the DSM, I believe, is what it's the acronym of. But homosexuality used to be pathology, and that's been in the public discourse for a while as a point for, you know, against progressing down this feeling oriented way of legislating. But the logic follows of, well, if eventually popular opinion sways in support of something absurd, because mind you, 40 or 50 years ago, homosexuality being legal, that thought was absurd. You know, if we think about polygamy, which is now in the public discourse of, well, if homosexuals are able to have these rights, then polygamous marriages should have these rights.
there is no way you're going to be able to deny a polygamist the right to marry.
And
under this decision, they are going to have that right.
And the logic will keep on feeding itself until, well, then, and this is where no one wants to address this, but the logic still stands of, well, what if the majority opinion supports murder? And might I submit that in Nazi Germany, that could have been possibly the case, where you look at the majority opinion, quote-unquote, believed that the Jews were the problem and that they needed to be exterminated. And history is appalled at that.
Rightfully so. And I think they're going to be appalled at this decision when we have had a chance to really reflect on it and its implications as a nation. And that's why I think that our first and most pressing need right now is for dialogue. We need to be talking about this decision in our churches, in our communities, in our workplaces, because we have to come to grips with the implications of this decision. They are enormous. They are really manifold, and I don't think we have really come to grips with that.
Mike, can I interrupt with one additional thought that kind of builds on all of this?
Certainly.
We're talking about marriage as a right here, as described in this opinion. And we really need to think more deeply about that. And, of course, this is the opinion of the Justice Kennedy and the four supporting justices, that marriage is a right. So if it is a right, then the exercise of that right may not be licensed as a privilege by the state. Okay, so the opinion of the majority implies that all marriage licenses issued by the states violate the Constitution. But the explicit opinion does not say that. So we must conclude that the states are acting within their power by issuing licenses. So we really need to come back to the assertion by the majority that marriage is a right. And the Constitution, the Supreme Court's powers are described in Article 3, Section 1 of the Constitution. You know, what can the Supreme Court do? And it says the judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court. Nothing else. Doesn't say that the Supreme Court can identify and assert new rights. Well, who has that responsibility? Judicial power is the power to judge the facts in a case according to the law or equity. And de Tocqueville observed in Democracy in America that the judiciary in the United States is also uniquely empowered to determine if a law is constitutional. A lot of power, but it's judiciary. But does the judiciary have the power to assert a new right not described in the Constitution? And that is precisely what the majority has done in this case. Or has the majority usurped powers that are inherent elsewhere? And here's the key question. Now, constitutions do various things. Among these are the assertion of rights, and particularly in bills of rights. It is generally recognized that a right can only be asserted if it is anchored in the natural law. Who then has the power to assert these rights according to the natural law? It is the people through the constitutional ratification process. So, in effect, Justice Kennedy and his cohorts, it appears, are guilty of the most flagrant of usurpations of people's powers.
Because these laws, or these rights, rather, the fundamental difference between America, the great experiment that it was, is that the founders determined that these rights did not come from the state, but that they were inherent just by you being a member of the human race. You had these rights that were given to you by God, as they so wrote in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. These rights endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights that are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And no one thinks about that anymore.
That is precisely correct. And the point here is that we're dealing with mutually exclusive ideas. A right which is anchored in natural law, and a privilege which is granted by government. A privilege may be licensed. A right may never be licensed. We have a fundamental contradiction that the opinion has created here.
And the distinction between privileges and rights, a privilege may be the privilege to be able to run for office. The privilege may be of that to own your own business, or to be involved more heavily in matters of government. Those would be looked at more as privileges. Even voting, that could even be looked at as a privilege, not necessarily a right. But that,
absolutely.
But that distinction is something that is for much more discourse than we're going to have time to discuss today. I think it's interesting that, Gary, you talk about discussion, how that's so important for us on this issue, and that's really what needs to be had. Well, the climate surrounding this decision is really against any kind of discussion in the matter. It is, you must be for this, if not, you're a bigot. And I find that very interesting, because it is trying to go against the very thing that you say we need. We need to have discussion on this. People who are not only for, but also against the decision of the Supreme Court, gay marriage, and that there needs to be discourse. Well, the atmosphere tends to be that of, well, be quiet and accept this. If you disagree, you have no place in the discourse.
Well, there was discourse taking place before this decision. Unfortunately, the discourse that was taking place was being done in the media. That's where the discussion was taking place, not in the churches and in the parlors and the living rooms of America. That's where the discussion, unfortunately, should have been taking place, and it didn't. But now it is absolutely imperative that it do so. Or as I say, as I point out in the essay, the implications of this are enormous. You are not going to be able to tell a polygamous couple or a polygamous group that they can't get married now. You're not going to be able to tell a man that he can't marry his daughter, because marriage is now defined simply as personal autonomy and whatever feels good. How are you going to deny those things? Just because Justice Kennedy used the phrase two people in his decision, there's no constitutional basis for that. That was a personal opinion. And personal opinion is not going to be sustained in the legal system. It shouldn't be. But now, how are you going to use this decision to deny anything more in terms of marriage than we already have? You're not. It's ludicrous to think that you can stop this.
Well, this is very plainly, I believe, a battle between good versus evil, quite frankly, because of that, what you described right there, because logic has no holding in this, and which leads me to make the conclusion of this has nothing to do with liberty or equality or rights, because logic goes out the window. This has to do with the mores of people in society, which forever shift, and nations have risen and fallen because of that. More than the case, they have fallen. They have risen because of principle, and they have fallen because of mores. Just like Rome decayed from the inside out, we are going to be decaying from the inside out and eventually fall as a nation if we keep on letting ourselves be swayed by these mores. Now, the Christian community is going to be the one who gets behind those ideals I just described. Is this going to, and this is the question everyone is waiting for, our ministers, is the Christian community going to be forced to have to embrace homosexual marriage in a way they're not comfortable with?
Well, the implications seem to point that way. I mean, that seems to be where they're going, and it will remain to be seen whether the homosexual community presses this case to that extent or not. They'd be wise not to, but I think that they will try to certainly press this, take this decision, and use it to force ministers and churches to comply.
Phil?
Well, I'm sure they're going to press it as far as they can.
And
I mean, this is basically an affirmation of a lifestyle or a sexual preference, and what they want is for society as a whole to accept this as normal.
Now, where it gets a little hairy is you have the intersection between a minister, which actually is licensed by the state to issue marriage licenses. So that's where the issue, you have the crossroads of the church and the state intersecting, where you could have the state saying, well, you're not going to be able to issue a marriage license if you are not going to be willing to marry homosexuals. You must be willing to marry homosexuals if you're going to do that. So that is the hairy part.
Yeah, we're going to have to understand that we need to get into the related issues here, and not just treat the symptoms of this, and that's going to include, you know, to what extent is the state really entitled to license? There are very few privileges that I can think of. You know, it was interesting when you went through that list. I'll grant you that they kind of tend in that direction, but an argument could have been made that these were more in the area of rights than privileges. So, you know, what is it that the state is allowed to license as a privilege? Well, I can think of some things. An exclusive license to sell a product, let us say. That certainly would be a privilege, but on the other hand, it's a disregard for our free enterprise system and for the freedom of contract and so forth. And so we're going to have to look very, very deeply at the overall picture here and not just focus on one narrow part of this.
And unfortunately, we've become a short attention span nation, and you know, there's no big surprise that this decision was announced on a Friday, because everyone's attention then turned to the weekend immediately thereafter. Oh, ho-hum, there's another decision now. What's going to happen this weekend? So we as a nation need to make some fundamental changes in how we regard Supreme Court decisions and how we discuss them. We've got to keep this in the national conscience, and we've got to keep this in the national dialogue, just as abortion has been. Roe v. Wade didn't settle the abortion question. That question is still being debated today, and I hope that we won't have to wait 40 years to see some reversal of this decision as we've had to wait for Roe v. Wade.
Now, the Texas Attorney General is actually encouraging state officials with religious considerations to defy this ruling by the Supreme Court. Ted Cruz is even saying that states should ignore it. So the discourse is most certainly continuing on homosexual marriage. That wraps up our program today. Thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to We the People, the Constitution Matters on 1180 WFYL. We are working for your liberty and wish you a happy Independence Day. From myself, Gary, and Phil, have a wonderful weekend. We will see you next week as we talk about issues of the Constitution, the day, what we can learn from the history, and how what that means for us as a nation. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFYL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.